on the right-hand side of the KBOO.FM website, under Community Events.
KPFA brings the listening public the other point of view.
There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KBOO presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA On the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA On the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, and opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KBOO, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
I'm Joshua Samuel Brown, and this is Improbability Drive. Today we'll be looking at social media, specifically at how writers are increasingly using social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter as part of their work. As a writer, I have something of a mixed relationship with social media. I love the ease with which I can get positive feedback for my work, but I'm less thrilled with the way social media eats up so much of my time. I've also become increasingly aware of how social media tends to feed my, let's just call them my narcissistic tendencies. Several years ago, Richard Deming, a dear friend and fellow writer, made a quip about me. This was before social media had become big, so it was probably over the phone or by email. Richard called me a classic narcissist. Richard is a poet and a philosopher, not to mention a writing professor at Yale University. So naturally, his words carry weight for me. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I didn't fully understand what the term classic narcissist meant, and, taking it as a compliment, promptly put it up on my website along with some other blurbs made by friends and well-wishers after the publication of my first book. Only later did I realize that Richard might not have meant it as quite the compliment I took it to be. Social media is playing an increasingly important role in the world. For writers especially, social media seems to be opening a lot of doors, helping us to catch the attention of readers, agents, and even publishers, even as the publishing industry itself changes. But are the shortened bursts of information required by social media also shortening our attention spans? Might social media be dumbing us down? Over the next half hour, I'll be discussing this question with a number of other writers. I'm Joshua Samuel Brown. And this is Improbability Drive on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. The first person I spoke to was Celeste Brash. Like me, Celeste has worked as a travel writer for the past several years. She uses social media as both a research tool and as a way to connect with readers as she travels around the globe for guidebook giant Lonely Planet. I know that for me, as a travel writer, there's a time when I felt that the tail was wagging the dog insofar as social media, where my digital persona had actually become more important than me and the work that I was actually doing. What's your take on that?
Yeah, social media is something that has to be balanced. I find that I'm actually rarely balanced with my social media. Either I'm on it all the time and kind of obsessive with it, or right now I haven't been on in about 2 days. And I couldn't care less about it, which I think is honestly probably more healthier psychologically. I can thrive in social media in two ways. If I'm on the road and doing really interesting things and have a lot to say, I can stop for 5 minutes. I tend to jot down a couple notes in my notebook of things I'm going to tweet about or things I'm going to put on Facebook. And then I'll just put that out there when I have the time. Instagram's another good one because I can take pictures from the road. When I'm not on the road is a lot more difficult because I tend not to have a lot to say, or I can just talk about stuff that I'm researching, that I'm writing, which can either be incredibly engaging or not engaging at all.
Have you ever felt that your being able to pitch yourself for a book was influenced by you're having a digital persona, having a Facebook following, a Twitter following, that sort of thing?
It really depends on the editor. Some editors aren't on social media at all, and you can mention it and they'll say, oh, cool, and move on to the next thing, and it doesn't mean a thing to them. Other editors have actually heard of me because of social media. I've engaged with editors via social media and then pitched to them later, and because of that, they know who I am. They see I have a big following. They see that I know a lot of people and that I'm well-connected, and that helps. It definitely won't get you a job, but it definitely gets you in the door.
You use the phrase well-connected. Do you think that there's something of an illusory quality to those connections that we have over social media?
Actually, it sounds like I should say yes, but in fact, in my experience, the answer is no, because I've met many of the people that I know via social media in real life, and we've become friends. And we've already sort of felt like we were friends before we met, and that's happened to me on many, many occasions.
Is there any fear that social media might either diminish the need for travel writers or put us out of business entirely? I mean, now that you can get on Facebook and actually start conversations with people who own guest houses in hotels all over the world, doesn't it make more sense for readers to just go that way as opposed to buying one of our guidebooks?
Sure, if you don't have to work and you don't have a job and you have, you know, hours of free time on your hands to organize and plan your own vacation and weed one hotel out of 150 on a resort island and decide that you're going to write to them, and they're going to tell you that they're great no matter what. So, I mean, no resort is going to say, no, I don't think we're for you, actually. Our beds are hard, our toilets stink, but we do have a fresh coat of paint, which you might like.
Earlier this year, there was a, how do you want to put this? What is the diplomatic way to put this?
There was a massive layoff at Lonely Planet.
I think you created a hashtag called LP Memories. What was initially the purpose of this hashtag?
Well, basically, all the people that I've been working with for years who I know and love just got fired. And being a travel writer, any kind of writer, you know, you're at home by yourself and you hear this horrible news and you want to reach out to somebody and you want to, you know, talk to people. But, you know, all the people that got laid off were in Melbourne or the Bay Area. And I'm sitting up here in Portland. So in sort of grief, I started this LP Memories, thinking of all the good times that I'd had, trying to sort of make a positive spin on it, I guess, trying to make myself feel better and hoping that I would make other people feel better, too.
What happened with the hashtag?
It went really crazy. I've never used hashtags before. What I did was the first memory that I had was about a taxi driver in Sulawesi, and that he was that he honked at everything. And when there was nobody or nothing to honk at, he would honk at sticks in the road. And then I put the hashtag LP Memories. And that's not even a great memory, but it was the first thing that came into my mind. And then I put another memory or two up there. And then a couple other Lonely Planet authors happened to be online, and they put up their memories.
I immediately saw that and I said, oh, this is going to get a lot of hits. I want people to see my pretty face. So I put up, you know, an LP memory that also happened to have a great picture attached to it, because I knew lots of people would see my picture. Does that make me narcissistic, or is that the way it's supposed to work?
Social media is narcissistic by nature, and
right,
that makes you better at social media. Because what I saw is I hadn't put photos, and I saw that the ones that did have photos were getting retweeted more and were getting more response than the ones without pictures. So after that, I started putting pictures on there.
We both wound up being in the New Yorker, at least on their website.
Yeah, which was pretty exciting.
Now, with the hashtag LP Memories, it seemed as if almost immediately it left this small circle of friends talking about Lonely Planet. And it was, I don't want to say hijacked, or opened up to people wanting to write about how much they loved Lonely Planet.
Well, I wanted it to be that way.
Okay.
I mean, about the third tweet I got back was from Elizabeth Eves, who's a well-known writer. And she said, is it just for authors or is it for everyone? And I said, oh, well, it's for everybody. It's for people who have used Lonely Planet. It's for editors. It's for authors. It's for anybody who's really been touched by using the guides. There was one woman, I wish I could remember her name, but she had the best tweets, and she probably tweeted about 25 times, and they were all really good. And that made me happy, because that's kind of, it's for everybody. I didn't want to have like a small, you know, little club where, oh, you can't tweet that. That's only for me to tweet.
I don't think that you can close people out of a tweet or out of a hashtag.
Yeah. I mean, it would be silly if that's how you feel. You should get off of social media and go on some unsocial form of media.
I want to talk actually about the tail wagging the dog aspect of it.
Okay.
What people don't realize is a lot of our job is pretty boring. It's going to hotels and making sure that their bathrooms are clean and getting the prices right and stuff like that. I would say that's probably maybe 75% of the job. Would you say that's about right?
At least, yeah.
75 to 85. I started like tarting up things, making something like a trip to the bus station to ascertain the bus schedules.
If you're really good at social media, you'll find something quirky and interesting at that bus station, which will be of great interest to lots of people. And there will be something, because everybody has sat at a bus station, that everybody can relate to. And then people will go, wow, that's in Thailand. How funny. I had that same experience in Canada or whatever. I mean, if it's a piece of graffiti or a photo or, you know, just somebody on a motorbike with five kids riding on with him, or I mean, there's a million things. And I think a person who's good at social media sees the world in sort of a different way. And you start to look for those things, which I don't know is a positive thing or a negative thing, because sometimes I find myself thinking in tweets and I don't like that necessarily. But at the same time, it does angle your thoughts into appreciating what might otherwise be mundane.
One complaint that's been levied towards social media is that it has made us, you just said thinking in tweets, it's made us more shallow.
The size of a tweet is representative of people's attention spans, and you can see that in lots of other things. You can see that in how we write guidebooks, how we used to have big chunks of text.
Sure.
Now everything is broken up, and we need to have it color-coded so people can look at each little bit without, you know, straining their eyes or whatever.
Is this a positive thing? I mean, that it seems as if feeding into that instinct for short, sharp sound bites may be, you know, basically just shortening our attention spans even further.
I think it probably does shorten our attention span even more. I think that overall it will probably change the way that most people think, and probably the human brain. I don't know how, but in long term, I'm sure we'll definitely see repercussions. Whether that's good or bad, who knows?
Next, I spoke with Cherie Lasota, a novelist based in Portland. Cherie uses social media both to connect with readers and to promote her work. In addition to publishing traditionally, Cherie is also on the cutting edge of e-publishing, a medium in which being able to navigate social media is critical to success.
I've always been a story, not a teller, story writer. I don't tell stories, I write them.
Okay.
And then as the time went on, I started doing freelance fiction editing, and that sort of turned into ebook design eventually when I became obsessed with ebooks. And it just sort of exploded from there. And my first novel is out. It's called Artemis Rising. My second novel, I'm desperately trying to finish within a week. And that's called Echoes in the Glass. I'm trying to get that one out by Christmas.
Now, writers are being asked to use social media platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, to promote their own book.
Even if you're traditionally published, 90% of the marketing is all on your shoulders.
So many of my friends who are writers, you'll get their Facebook updates or like, please like the page for my new book. Please go to my Amazon page and write a review.
Mm-hmm.
So at what point do we cross that line from being a writer and just being a nudge?
I think it actually has to do with the timing, or rather how often those posts are put out. If you're posting every single post something about your writing or your book or your career or whatever, it gets really tiresome to your general public. I kind of go by the rule of thumb, I try to anyway, like once a week or once every 2 weeks. Or if there is some news out about, say, a new book out or something, I do more then, but then it'll taper off over time. And I think that helps. You know, people do want to support you, your friends, your colleagues. But up to a certain point, if you take it across the line, and we all pretty much know where the line is, most of the time it's the very, very new writers who don't know where the line is, and they do cross it, and it has terrible results for their career. I know somebody who got mad at a writer and started posting news about her own book on this woman's fan page on Facebook. Really horrible.
What platforms do you primarily use to promote your work?
I go back and forth. I would like to love Twitter, but I'm long-winded.
I've got my own beef with Twitter.
Oh, I'm sure everybody does have one social media network they really don't like. I actually don't like Facebook, but I use it the most.
Right.
The reason is every single person I love to talk to is on it. And they refuse to go over to Google Plus, which is where I want them to go.
Why Google Plus over Facebook?
Number one reason is SEO, search engine marketing, optimization and marketing.
Right.
But basically, it has to do with when you post on Google Plus, you go way, way high in the rankings on search engine optimization. And Facebook is a closed garden. You can't actually sort of search its contents. You're not unless you specifically choose to post publicly.
Okay.
You are posting only to your friends. And most of the time, you're reaching a very, very small percentage of your friends because Facebook has set it up that way so that you pay to get your posts seen by more of your own friends.
Sure.
It's ridiculous. It makes me very angry inside.
Maybe after this conversation, I will do Google Plus because sure. You seem to indicate that it's the better deal for writers.
Yeah.
And for me, like, we haven't even touched on LinkedIn Clout. And I just joined another one. And I can't keep track of them anymore.
From what I've heard from the experts, quote unquote, they basically say focus on one or two social networks and leave the rest. Basically go with what you like to do.
Right.
Everybody usually likes some kind of social network. And they're all different. They all have their pros and cons, whatever. But for me, I notice Google Plus and Facebook are my favorite just because they sort of encourage longer postings and I can do a lot more with it. With Twitter, I usually am sharing other people's book news. I do that more than anything. But I have found it's a very public social network, so it does have its uses. And
you're talking about Twitter or Google?
Twitter. Well, actually, Google too.
I get retweeted more on Twitter, and that's a whole other area. Sometimes I find myself retweeting somebody's tweet because I'm like, well, one hand washes the other.
Yeah.
I'm building up some sort of retweet karma here,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
that I'll call on one day or,
right.
or.
From what I understand, when you really boil social media down, it's about having a meaningful connection, and that's the whole purpose. When you talk about marketing on a social network, it's always about meaningful connections. And so in other words, 100 followers who are really engaging with you are much better than 1,000 or 2,000 or 20,000.
Okay.
Because you're reaching a loyal fan base who will connect with you on a personal level. And then when they hear about your news every once in a while, say a new book out or whatever, they would be more inclined to purchase it and share the news about that. That's the key, is word of mouth. I mean, that's where you're going to be either successful or you're going to fail, is with word of mouth.
Do you think that it is more difficult or less difficult to make a living as a writer with the current social media landscape and with the current changing landscape of publishing in general?
The answer is a resounding yes. It is much easier to be an author and to be wildly successful today than it's ever been in the history of publishing. Number one reason is self-publishing. I know a lot of people who are literally now New York Times bestsellers, and they're indie publishers. They're indie writers. They just hit it big. They had a market. They knew what to do. They have multiple books out, multiple series out, and that's a huge part of it, is series books. If you can snag a reader with their first in a series, and usually you have to snag them with either a 99-cent price point or free. If you can snag them there and then get them to read the rest of your series, you've got a fan for life. And they will do the work for you. They will market it for you. And it's so much easier when other people are praising your work and sharing it rather than you having to do it. When you boil it down, it's that small connection between the reader and the writer. Anyone beyond that first person who ever said to me they love my writing is icing on the cake.
That social media should play an important role in the work of travel writers and novelists is something of a no-brainer. But in the very sensitive area of human rights work, social media is becoming increasingly important, and knowing how to navigate the social media landscape can sometimes literally be a matter of life and death. Joining me now on the phone from New York City is my old friend and senior researcher for Human Rights Watch, Phelim Kine.
So I work for Human Rights Watch, and Human Rights Watch is an international human rights organization. We do research on more than 90 countries. We document human rights abuses. We publish our research, and we try to seek action to, number one, bring an end to those abuses, seek redress for the victims, and to bring the perpetrators to justice.
How long have you had the social media presence? Because I don't remember seeing you on Twitter and Facebook much earlier than last year.
I launched my social media presence in September of 2011. which is sort of mid-range for people in my organization realizing the absolute necessity of having a social media presence to both be in contact with key stakeholders, whether it's journalists, diplomats, and other non-government organizations, as well as a way to disseminate our own information and our findings and our research.
With travel writers, with my friend who's the novelist, our work doesn't put us in harm's way, but your work does. Aren't you ever concerned that maybe the wrong people might say, oh, Phelim Kine is going to be coming to our country to, what's the quote about Human Rights Watch? It's an irritant to how many governments? You know the quote that I'm talking about?
I know exactly the quote you're talking about. The other quote is, tyranny has a witness, that we also use for our organization. And you bring up a very good point, and that's the sense that social media usage for people in my organization, particularly those who are dealing with countries that are particularly authoritarian, vindictive, which do not welcome the scrutiny of outsiders, particularly human rights organizations, have to be fairly, if not extremely, discreet in terms of what they do online. And in particular, they don't flag, I'm going to X location for X number of weeks from tomorrow. And so there is some self-censoring to a certain extent to ensure a certain level of discretion in case advertising one's movements might put oneself or one's contacts and sources under untoward government surveillance or interference.
Imagine that the internet had been invented in the 1890s. Would the atrocities of the 20th century, would they have been able to have occurred? I mean, if people were tweeting, there's something going on at that big camp next door, there's smoke rising and trains with people are going in but not going out.
Yeah.
Do you think that would have prevented some of the atrocities of the 20th century?
It's one of the great what ifs. I think I'd answer that by saying by remarking that it's interesting that just in the past week, I believe that the British Museum or a British government agency has opened to the public thousands and thousands of letters that were written by soldiers on the Western Front during the First World War, which of course was a absolutely atrocious killing machine that killed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of British, French, and German troops. The reason these letters never got delivered was that they revealed the fears of the soldiers, the low morale, the concerns about conditions, reports of just how horrific the conditions in front and the killing was. And I think to address your question, I mean, this is only coming out almost 100 years later. And if that type of information was coming out in real time or within 6 months or a year of 1914, 1915, would the public have allowed that? I don't know. It's an interesting question. And again, it's the what if of history. But I think we can see now that when images are circulated, you know, for example, right now we have images circulating of atrocities apparently committed by the forces of Syrian President Assad with regards to chemical weapons. We also see images that appear to be summary extrajudicial killings by the Syrian rebels, the Free Syrian Army against Syrian soldiers. These catalyze people's attention. They create conversations, and they are provoking serious discussion about how the U.S. government at this point should or should not conduct or involve itself with the Syrian conflict. So I think right now we are seeing a real-life, real-time example of how the internet, how social media, how the fact that images and information can be disseminated to hundreds of millions of people instantaneously for real-time discussions are having an influence or an input on a crucial piece of United States foreign policy.
As I look through your Facebook page, what I see is that you'll be posting things like there'll be a hard-hitting article that you've written that maybe was just published in the Wall Street Journal about a tremendously important human rights issue. Then it'll be something that somebody else has written that's also about a human rights issue. And then it'll be maybe just a picture of you and your girlfriend having lunch and enjoying a quiet moment in Prospect Park. So is there something of a Trojan horse in a social media persona for a person who does what you do?
That's a really good question. You know, there's nothing calculated about my Facebook page per se. I mean, it's a representation of me and my life. And so obviously I thread through it elements of my personal life with my work life and the things that I do. There are two things that I actually, you know, want to do, and I think it's important that a Facebook page or social media of any kind not be like some kind of corporate feed. There has to be some human element. There has to be some, you have to be genuine. And so what I like about the fact that I balance sort of elements of, you know, what I do on the weekends and a recent dish that I cooked, you know, with quinoa, with, for example, an op-ed I wrote about rising religious intolerance in Indonesia, is that it allows people who know me on a personal basis to have a more rounded view of me. And I actually do hope, and it does happen from time to time, that people will read something about an issue that Human Rights Watch, that I personally am following and pursuing and doing advocacy on, and come back with comments and say, you know, I had no idea about that. And that was, and that's really, that's fascinating, or that's horrifying, or, you know, it's not a platform which I'm consciously seeking to advocate on and to expand my number of eyes and clicks. That's just value added. But the fact is that if you can connect or touch someone in that way, I think that's pretty effective.
A longer version of our conversation, in which Phelan talks about the increasing role of social media in China and in other areas, is posted at my SoundCloud page. That's at soundcloud.com/Joshua Samuel Brown. There's a hyphen between those names. Finally, I spoke to my old friend Richard Deming. While I'd initially thought that Richard was the one friend I had still abstaining from social media, over the course of our conversation, I learned that this wasn't quite the case. You have basically been the one friend that I have who has refused to get on Facebook, on Twitter, and basically you shun social media. I'm curious as to why that is.
Well, I have to come clean. I'm on one, and that's LinkedIn.
Whore.
The only reason I'm on LinkedIn is because I didn't know how social media works. And so I got an email from someone saying, you know, whoever it was, you know, would like you to be part of LinkedIn. And I thought, oh, well, he wrote me and I would feel bad if I didn't sign on. And so I signed on and only later realized that that's just done completely automatically. And the person would have no idea if I did or I didn't. It wasn't personalized at all. So I was sort of like tricked into it. I was guilted into it, which is obviously how it's supposed to work.
You thought that you were special to this person.
No, I didn't think I was special, but I think it works either as flattery, that sort of special, I guess, feeling special, or in my case, guilt, that if I ignored it, if I didn't answer, I didn't respond, it would be read as a rejection.
But you don't use the other major social media platforms. You don't use Facebook or Twitter
No.
or Instagram or any of those things. The other writers who I've spoken to talk about how that helps to promote their careers as writers. Why have you chosen not to use these platforms?
I think it's because that's what I see its usefulness as, is this sort of promotional tool. And I feel that I'm not commercially motivated as an artist. And so then to undertake that seems, would be out of character, would be out of my temperament.
But now I understand that you've softened your stance?
No, I haven't softened it. I think you're talking about the fact that I'm putting together Facebook accounts, Twitter accounts for Yale's creative writing program.
You had mentioned that, but I was looking in a mirror while you were saying that, so I was distracted. Sorry. Ooh, pretty.
I'm glad you have your priorities straight.
Pretty.
Yeah, so what is your question?
So you are now using social media as part of your job as a creative writing professor?
Well, I mean, no. Part of my job as the director of creative writing. And so for me, that's really about the institution and about promotion and really not even promotion in the sense of advertising, but letting our students know, letting people in the New Haven community know, letting people everywhere know the sorts of things that are happening, and then they can partake of it. So it's really it's really service oriented rather than, say, self promotion or advertising.
But it's not your own personal Facebook page. It's not Richard Deming's Facebook page.
Exactly. I'll still not get on those.
When did you give me that quip, a classic narcissist? I remember putting it on my website.
I wouldn't put that in public.
But I did. And what does that say about me?
So just proving my point.
See, and this is the thing. Being a narcissist is a good thing in the world of social media. And I think that the fact that I'm uncomfortable with social media means that there might be some hope for me.
Could be.
That's all the time we have. I'd like to thank my guest, Celeste Brash, Twitter handle at Radio Celeste, Cherie Lasota, Twitter handle at Cherie Lasota, that's C-H-E-R-I-L-A-S-O-T-A, and Phelim Kine, Twitter handle at Phelim Kine, that's P-H-E-L-I-M-K-I-N-E. Thanks also to Richard Deming, who doesn't have a Twitter handle. Yet. I'm Joshua Samuel Brown, Twitter handle at Joe Sambro, that's at J-O-S-A-M-B-R-O. Thank you for listening to Improbability Drive on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon.
It's time for the KBOO News headlines for Thursday, October 31st. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Nastasia Voisin.
In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the Green Fire Management Firm is fixing to create clean energy from liquid organic waste. The company boasts 2.6 million gallons of storage. The waste will be trucked into the area outside of the Menominee Casino and will off-gas fermented methane to create fuel. The plant is wholly owned by the Potawatomi tribe. The plant will create 2 megawatts of power, enough to heat 1,500 homes.
That dreaded takeoff power down of electronic devices may be over, according to Tuesday announcement from the Federal Airline Administration. Until now, United States passengers were forbidden to use electronic devices until their planes rose above 10,000 feet. Now air travelers will be free to use handheld devices, tablets, and laptops from gate to gate. Cell phone use will still be prohibited during flights in accordance to FCC's ban on airborne cell phone calls. The FAA previously enforced electronic power downs for safety reasons. During takeoff and landing, radio signals from devices were thought to interfere with an aircraft's control systems. As